Well,
I'm just gonna say something really awesome about photographs while he's outside.
That's I'm going to delegate that job to Peter himself.
Yeah, oh yeah, Mister.
On a rather general note, is that we have how much? 50 minutes left, right? Is that okay?
No,
it's
12:30,
no?
12:30.
All right.
Okay. Thank goodness.
But I've been wondering if we could kind of agree maybe that we reserve a time slot for something like an open discussion, especially in light of the Chuck Barney essay, right?
Yes.
So that, would it be okay if you kind of another 15 minutes?
Yes, kind of absolutely. I would like to do it that way, actually.
Yeah. Great.
We've been talking about the logistics of a certain kind of agriculture that went viral, right? And we've been talking about how it can be reduced to a paradoxical sentence that says something like, this is not just a sentence, right? That's a funny sentence because if you do to it what Quine likes to do to sentences, it still remains itself, strangely. You could say, isn't just a sentence, isn't just a sentence. It still wouldn't just be a sentence, right, which is odd, but I haven't thought about that enough because it just occurred to me. We were just talking, or rather I was listening, while Claire was saying quite accurately that Hegel goes there quite a lot. He accepts the idea that contradiction inheres in things, not just in human things. I guess one's obvious issue with it, Hegel that is that first of all he's one of these people who's found some kind of cement that happily gets rid of this gap that I'm talking about, this sort of traumatic gap, which actually Nick Land described as a shock wave or something like panic attack between phenomenon and thing of Kant. And what he gets rid of is, the way he does it is says, well, I can think this gap, therefore there is no gap, because there is not just a subject that's different from little me, there is a Geist, right? And in the end, there is a definitely positive progression from things like plants, right, which is the topic I want to talk about a little bit, to God knowing probably himself or itself, but probably not herself or themselves, if we're reading Hegel. I think the problem in Hegel is not so much that he is into that kind of teleological view or whatever, because it's quite true that he thinks about non-human entities quite a bit. It's the thing at the very beginning of the logic, which is a kind of exclusion of a certain kind of sentence that reminds me of the basic operational procedure of agri-logistics, which is to exclude certain things that are already there, right? Or to try to, impossibly. And this would be the mathematical sentence, A equals A, right? He says that's how you start this book, called The Logic, but it isn't logic. It's outside of logic, but it's how I have to start it. It's just pure self-reference, otherwise known by a pejorative term for him, a completely blank nothingness, the night in which all counts are black, otherwise known elsewhere in Hegel as Buddhism. Right? Buddhism is this thing where people get themselves stuck in A equals A, self-referentiality. And if you look at kind of critiques of Buddhism and also of consumerism, you see that what people don't like about it is that it's this narcissistic, self-fellating, masturbatory, ouroboric loop, right, where you kind of put yourself into a pretzel, right? The yoga is a way to make yourself into a loop, right? And so I was thinking that but this is supposed to be about flowers, you know, so how does that relate? Well, one of the questions you could ask, and this is a seminar about eco-criticism, is how does this all relate to looking at artistic things, what we have to look at in departments like art history and English? So you could start with the idea that poems about flowers, which is, you know, a little bit this poem, you know, are very interesting because they're always poems about tropes, right? Because a trope is a flower of rhetoric. That's why you call it an anthology, right? It's a collection of flowers, yeah? But what if tropes were not just like flowers? What if they actually were more deeply connected to flowers, actually? What if there wasn't just a kind of nice metaphorical analogy between tropes and flowers, and I would also say viruses, but actually, and sentences like this is not a sentence, but actually flowers really are tropes in a certain way, and tropes really are flowers. And therefore, what if lines of poetry, and indeed lines of things that pretend not to be poetry, because they're supposed to be very serious rather than playful, were actually not only non-human beings in the Husserlian sense of mind-independent, you know, logical structures that prevent you from being in an infinite materialist regress, right? But were actually implants of plants, right? This is somewhat the same kind of wacky question that New Agey type people, and therefore also suspiciously self-flagellating and narcissistic people, and a defence of Buddhism really has to be a defence of narcissism, actually. There are Buddhists who've internalised this anti-consumerist logic, because lots of Buddhists, lots of Western Buddhists were consumerists, right? They said, well, I'm not that awful Western Buddhist, you know, that Zizek says is evil because they masturbate, you know, in their procedures. I'm the real kind of Buddhist who's really hard and serious. But, you know, what if Buddhism actually wasn't that? What if it actually was actually much more like a kind of self-pleasuring that we've decided is illegal or evil, and precisely because it's loop-like, right? Serpentine. What if Salvador Dali's poem about Narcissus, right, the painting Narcissus, it's about a flower growing in someone's head, right? What if a thought or a trope literally was that, not just like a kind of metaphorical, logical structure version of it, but an actual non-human being, right? And this is where the New Agey scientists, like Terence McKenna's brother, will tell you about human-plant co-evolution, right, and how thoughts derive from hallucinations, right, which derive from human-plant interactions, such as smoking them or eating them or drinking them in certain ways, and that, therefore, the hallucination is the possibility condition for the thought, which sounds to me like a kind of Deleuze-Guattarian thing to say, and that also, therefore, the flower is the possibility condition for the hallucination, and that, therefore, also DNA was the logical possibility condition, logically prior to, as well as historically, the flower. Now, that's a weird thing to say, actually, because from a DNA's point of view, right, if it went on Oprah and told you what it thought, it would say that sexual reproduction is an incredibly expensive waste of time, like having an English department or reading a poem. It doesn't make any sense. It's much better to have cloning, right? Which is a little bit is agri-logistics in a way. It's much cheaper, you know, not to have these things that are, you know, very useless, beautiful, and yet obviously they have some causal influence, right? I'm somebody who thinks that causality is aesthetic, right? It's not some kind of machinery underneath things. It's actually a kind of weird, ghostly appearance that pours out of things. And this is Schopenhauer's interpretation of Kant. Actually, it's perfectly straightforward, Kant's interpretation of Hume, right? You can never see cause and effect. You can only see correlation, right? And so, in that sense, causality is in front. And what do we call the stuff that's in front? We call it appearance. And this kind of means, funny enough, that appearance, and this is where I disagree with Graham Harman, I'm the sort of upside-down, object-oriented chap, right, who's about to say something in my language that's very similar to what Claire said, right, which is that expression, right, is prior, right? In my language, appearance is prior, right? It's like a weird upside-down version. Now we're talking of Zizek and how sort of toxic I find him and how allergic to what I like narcissism, masturbation, and Buddhism, he is. He makes the joke all the time, which sort of says that, you know, that kind of ontological joke, which puts being in a kind of loop with appearance, but in the same way that Agri Logistics says this isn't just a sentence, actually.
Yeah. You arranged that, Tim.
I hate to say it.
We are all,
you know. Somebody didn't know where their next meal was coming from. So the joke is this, right? Ravelli may look, it's Groucho Marx, right? Ravelli may look like an idiot, he may act like an idiot, but don't let that fool you. He really is an idiot, right? Which Zizek takes to be how, you know, the sort of ontological whateverness of a thing kind of sticks out of its appearance, right? But I think maybe my position is an upside down version of that joke, actually, which is, you know, it is like Hegel, but sort of upside down, right? Ravelli may be an idiot, actually, but don't let that fool you. He looks like and sounds like an idiot, right? In other words, there's something about appearance that is deeply disturbing and doesn't go away, right? When you try to get to what a being is, right? You know, the scientistic idea of science is that science is stripping away appearances to get to the thing underneath the appearances, right? That's constantly there, no matter what the appearances are, no matter who's looking at it or not. And this seems to, like, get in the way of an awful lot of actual scientific thoughts, including the one about how come there are flowers. I mean, not just quantum theory, but pretty standard DNA theory, which is it's really expensive for flowers to do, for plants to have flowers, actually. And you could sort of say that DNA, going back to that sequence, right, trope, thought, hallucination, plant, flower, virus, DNA, then, you know, DNA is a replicator, right, that replicates for no reason. There's something quite non-utilitarian in DNA, actually. And this is the case because there are non-organic chemicals that are self-replicators, you know, so people had to invent RNA world because DNA just popping out of nowhere didn't make any sense, so they had to invent a world before DNA. So the DNA scene is another one of these catastrophes that happened inside a bigger space called RNA world. But RNA world is also happening inside an even bigger space that's still persisting called self-replicating crystal structures, right? And that's happening inside an even bigger catastrophe called patterns, right? Patterns. Patterns are logically prior to things that they're patterns of, right? And what's scary about flowers and hallucinations and possibly thoughts is that they're just patterns, right? They don't really point to anything outside of themselves. And that's what's also scary about narcissism and yoga and putting yourself into a pretzel and, you know, why everybody stopped reading Irigaray when she started talking about yoga, you know? She was clearly kind of going away from, you know, critique or something. So, you know, I want to sort of stick up for narcissism because I want to stick up for poems, you know, and lines in poems. And the line in this Ashbery poem, this Ashbery poem is a poem about time, isn't it? And how time isn't a linear sequence of now points, right? And it clepsydra means that it's an old-fashioned clock, right? You know, if you were going to compare engineering to humanities in sort of pleasantly negative way, you could say, well, you know, the clepsydra may have gotten the grant money nowadays, as opposed to Plato's proposal for a complete works of, you know, Plato's version of Socrates. But what is actually something that people know about ancient Greece? They don't really know Clepsydras, right? They know the complete works of Plato. So 2,500 years from now, shit that we think will be really cool and important, and people will be like, oh, this is great. It's just that right now it has no meaning whatsoever, you know. There's this line in the poem that talks about the poem, right? This is why I find kitschy chocolate boxy flower poems really interesting. And this is obviously not a kitschy chocolate boxy flower poem, but it's in a way, it's like a weird kind of constructivist type, Wordsworth type, I can see through things type of a poem, trying to become a kitschy chocolate boxy poem, but that is a kind of narcissistic poem that we're not supposed to like, by putting itself into a loop. And you can sort of tell when it says, we'll just read it, right? Hasn't the sky returned from moving the other authority recently dropped, rested as much as that severe sunshine as you need now on the way you go? The reason why it happened only since you woke up is letting the steam disappear from those clouds when the landscape all around is hilly sights that will have to be reckoned into the total for there to be more air. That is, more fitness read into the underdeased result than land. This means never getting any closer to the basic principle operating behind it than to the distracted entity of a mirage. This is the one, right, which I think is amazing, kind of upside down, more realist version of Wordsworth. The half-meant, half-perceived motions of fronds out of the idle depths that are summer. Right? And those waving fronds, right, which are tropes, which are also kind of the way the poem is, right, but also the way, you know, the alien planet is in Solaris, the first scene of Solaris, which looks like a pastoral idyll where the dude is washing his hands in a pond, right, and the whole movie, of course, is also a sort of loop, is the waving plants, right? And we think of plants as, you know, alien somehow, and, despite Michael Marder and also the science of plant sentience, it's quite difficult to think about plants thinking, especially in the same way that it's difficult to think that sentences can think, or that viruses can think, which is also the problem of artificial intelligence, right? Can you have a string of code that performs something that looks and quacks like thinking enough for me to drop my idea that it isn't, right? Which sort of means that thinking is also a bit scary because you can't prove that it's happening, right? I can't prove that I'm intelligent, you know, no matter how many sentences I say. And so I guess this particular session was about how reality seems to produce useless stuff, and in a way flowers are like a polymerase chain reaction blow up of something intrinsic in reality, which is appearance, right? And I think Schopenhauer actually says it really well, because he's also another philosopher who, he really hated Hegel actually, but he talks about these sort of cosmic sort of fathomless depths of time, right? He says first of all that the plants are saying something like, I'm not just a flower, right? Which is like the agri-logistical sentence, actually. They're saying, please complete me. I don't quite know who I am, because you need to open the refrigerator door of me and find out, right? And they say this not just to humans, but also to, like, bees and whatever, you know. We don't really know about flowers, and we can't really say what they are, but we interact with them in a way that sort of, quote-unquote, makes them somewhat significant somehow. And this is sort of the way in which there is an inescapable, irreducible appearance dimension to things which you can't peel off. And that's the opposite of the agri-logistical axiom that things can't be contradictory, right? Because if things can't be contradictory, then you can have these bland substances decorated with accidents, and your job is to get rid of the bland. Your job is to get rid of the accidents, right, which are just superficial. But if the accidents, if the appearance can't be peeled off of what it is without destroying it, right, which is what death is, right, it's when my appearance now coincides with what I am. In other words, I've become, like Sartre would say, like a wastebasket with paper in it and your memories of me and a feeling of grief and a coffin, right? And now I coincide with my appearance. That's called me being dead, right? When I'm not coinciding with my appearance, it's called me being live or existing, right? You can do the same with a wine glass, right? You can sing a note that resonates to the resonant frequency of the glass. When the frequency hits the glass has a little glass gasm, possibly, and goes into coherence with that wave, and then it explodes because its inner structure is fragile, that is, it's finite, and it's based on a gap between appearing and being, so that somehow the sound wave kind of irritates it into giving up its hamartia, like telling the truth about itself, which would mean ceasing to exist, right? Because for me, existing is the opposite of badiyu existing. It's like inconsistency, you know, pretense, right? And as Lacan says, the problem with pretense is that you don't know whether it's pretense or not, right? This isn't just a sentence. So the value of thinking about kind of literature as a way of thinking about things, you know, that's a kind of way in which I'm quite like Heidegger, I suppose. And how eco-criticism, you know, about poems doesn't have to be criticism that talks about things that seem to point outside of poems, right? That actually poems themselves don't just contain interesting non-human entities like tropes and ideas, they actually contain like plants, actually, or kind of footprints of plants or something like that, you know. I've managed to somehow give myself a reason for living as an English professor. And I think that the problem with narcissism is only a problem from the point of view of wounded narcissism. Like, in a way, there's only narcissists and wounded narcissists. The wounded narcissist is the one who has narcissistic personality disorder, right? Because the wounded narcissist, whose loop has been, like, broken at some point, sees the closed loop of some other being or whatever person and is irritated by the weird paradoxical closure, right? So then, Derrida is right in saying that there is no one narcissism. You can't get rid of it. What you have to do is imagine it including lots of other entities, right? And of course it does already include other entities because it's like the self-swallowing snake. It's a snake that includes itself, right, in the same way that a circle is a kind of including of itself in a provocative way. Or indeed, you know, self-referential sentences are kind of including themselves. Or indeed, the thing that Hegel hates, right, to go back to that, A equals A, is a possibility condition for logic, actually, is this kind of maddening self-reference that people try to get rid of, that they call, you know, narcissism, right? And which is why, in the end, the reaction to ecology world is not just horror. It's not just completely sort of stasis, rubbernecking, home alone face, alien scientist people, you know, affect. It's more like laughter, right? But the laughter is to be found inside the horror rather than despite it. Right, because we don't want the laughter to be sadistic laughter, which again reproduces this rigid difference between me and the other, which is might be the problem. But we don't want to completely collapse it either, right? So narcissism is an ecologically functional, politically good state, which isn't just an emotion state, right? It's actually a physical, psychophysical feedback state. It's just that whenever we think about it that way, we think it means weird, mystical, Indian stuff that we still don't want to do because we have to define ourselves as non-Eastern people somehow in scholarship. So there is a kind of yoga of thought, right, which is why I'm calling this eco-gnosis, right? It's a kind of posturing of thought rather than thinking of something that isn't the thought as a kind of act that is intrinsically ecological, right, and knows what it is, but not in a kind of smug, millions of miles away from, you know, the given way, in a sort of Archimedes way. It's a kind of self-knowing that also isn't little me somehow. So that's why I think in answer to your question earlier, like one of the things we could do was to be like better narcissists, right? As a way to not transcend consumerism, but to actually stop trying to delete whatever consumerism is about, which is why we have things like consumerism. So that's the secret passageway to ecology, is through the, you know, the sort of kitschy psychedelic craft shop of the early 70s with a little bit of a rigoureux. We already saw it. We've already found the exit route, right? We don't need to do any more thinking. We just need to start finding nice ways of going down into the exit route, right? And, you know, in the end, the beauty experience is a kind of narcissistic feedback in which I experience something that might be me or might not be me, right? The Kantian beauty experience is a kind of weird trace of something that might not be me. I can't specify that it isn't me. It has a kind of weird virtuality to it. And so I don't need, you know, pebbles to kick to know that there is at least one other entity, because I can feel beauty, right? And the feeling of beauty is a kind of sadness, right? Inside the horror is a kind of depression, and inside the depression is a kind of coexisting, and inside that is a kind of sadness, right? Melancholia is knowing that you coexist, right? You can't peel the nasty stuff off of you, because you are the nasty stuff, right? And inside that is something more unconditional, which I'm calling sadness, which starts to involve this awareness that everything is in a kind of loop, right? And in the end, that's kind of thinking itself in a loop, is a kind of ecological thinking. That was much longer than... No. Maybe it was. Just a little bit.
Great. Thanks again. Yes. Or... rather. Shall we just open the discussion in light of both the poem and the...
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And it actually might begin, because we have been talking about there has been some kind of, you know, what are we going to do now? You know, you suggested that the exit door was somehow already open. But what for me opens the question of agency are actually two things. One is, if we let go of the principle of non-competition, which is a thought that I'm very sympathetic to, I have to say, how does that affect agency as such?
Right.
Obviously, agency itself is something that is very much discussed.
Yes. Well, yes.
Second.
Yeah.
As far as the concern. I found a contradiction, but maybe then that's something we have to happily endorse,
yes,
but then be get angry about, is the scenario that he kind of sets up is one between the assumption that nature is something that is back there, and history is written as historiography of agency. And mm-hmm. Agency is something that is human, while mm-hmm. nature is passive. And on the other hand, with the Anthropocene, this on the one hand seems to be like an alternative, mm-hmm. or open up an alternative, but the paradox, it seems to me, is that human agency is now so blown out of proportion, right? It's not re-envisaged compared to the passivity of nature, right? But it is actually even exaggerated, or it has become so large that it has become a geological force.
Yes.
So the fact is that agency, because agency has become so large and so effective, that it has reached this extent, is that we have to kind of conceive ourselves as as geological force ourselves, right?
I get that.
And that is what brings us kind of closer to the problem in a certain way. You think this can proceed.
Right.
And I wonder if there is, if the problem of agency does not pop up in what seems to me a certain kind of contradiction, right? Because on the one hand, the problem with classical historiography seems to be that it emphasizes agency that much. Now, this new version emphasizes agency to a degree, or enlarges it to a degree, that we become one with the very thing that we thought is only passive, right? So, I'm not quite sure whether the sheer fact that we have become a geological force somehow actually makes them, on the one hand, us part of San Geos, but on the other hand, empowers geological force in a way, because we have become
I'm hearing it. Yes, I'm hearing it. So, I could start this with a big argument that's more kind of general, which is that I don't believe in agency at all. So it's impossible to answer your question in a way that respects agency, because I think it's a kind of weird, mysterious Vaseline that we want to find in things, you know, kind of weird transparent gel, you know, that does something to something, but we can't quite know what it is, you know. The more local answer would be more like the answer I already gave, which is that the thought that the Anthropocene is a hubristic concept, right, that it makes humans into a far bigger and more powerful, is paradoxical in a couple of ways, right? First of all, it's not being honest enough about how big and powerful we actually sort of are, you know. But more broadly, because agency now must include, you know, sheep, cattle, grains, and then obviously also flowers, because grains are plants that you try to minimize the flower to maximize the constantly present stuff that you want to save off your anxiety with, right? And on and on and on. If you blow up agency so that it includes everything, then it kind of disappears, actually. If everything has agency, then in a funny way, agency just isn't a category anymore, because the whole game in that kind of cultural studies is to hunt the agency, you know. And it's sort of like, even in Latour, there's a problem, right? Mm. Because the idea is to find the agential something, you know. I'm looking for it, you know. But because I've included non-human beings, and because agency is always already an anthropocentric construct, I'm never going to find it, right? But my task is to produce the agency like a receipt out of a cash register, because that's how I show that I'm performing what I do to legitimate my intelligence, right? But this is the larger point. Right, yeah. Well, this is what I'm saying, right? This is also an idea about how we don't exactly progress to ecological awareness, actually, but we sort of weirdly regress, right? In my own idea, part of it is we need to regress to the early 70s, right? In another way, it's, you know, we need to regress to something that looks like narcissism that we don't like. In another way, it's a little bit like what Nietzsche, you know, says about, you know, that bit in the New Testament, right? You know, love thy neighbor as thyself, but first be such as love yourselves, right? Because how could you know how to do it, right? And then something that Adorno says about Nietzsche, actually, which is that I think he uses the word, some kind of phraseology like that, you know, actual progress looks like regression. Actual progress looks like decadence, right? As in Nietzsche crying because he saw the horse being whipped, right? It looks like this weak, lame, you know, how did the mammals survive the dinosaurs? Because they were really weak, right? Not because they were more powerful, right? So our job is to realize that, you know, we can't actually get out of that passivity that Claire's talking about. Like, the political job is, in a way, not to give us something to do, but to attune our susceptibility more, right? Because in the end, we're not nihilistic princes of darkness. We're actually very, a word that we all think we hate, sincere, right? Like the sincerity fish eats the irony fish in the end, right? So part of my job in my bailiwick at this is to try to find a kind of irony that is cute and sincere, right? And maybe this is just me, you know, justifying my Englishness, right? Because the English word for that is whimsical, right? And there's a long tradition of whimsicality going from Wind in the Willows, because it has the Piper at the Gates of Dawn, to early Pink Floyd, which is the Piper at the Gates of Dawn, Syd Barrett, right? Who then gets edited out in all sorts of ways by the people who want to make money out of it, and who is seen as insane for wanting to have a saxophonist and a female singer, but then gets back into it like weeds growing up through the concrete, because the album that puts them to number one and is the highest selling album of all time, or one of them, is the album where they use a saxophonist and several female lead singers, and that is also totally about Syd while excluding Syd at the same time. So it's like a really kitschy, serious version of madness, you know, that kind of includes, excludes the kind of playful juggler quality. And so it's a really interesting kind of thought about how, you know, becoming ecological isn't necessarily about doing something more, right? Or thinking that we have to do something more. If doing something more means, you know, stomping on what we did just now, you know, because then that's just modernity 2.0, which is agri-logistics 6.0, right? And so, like, it's a moment. You articulated it better than anyone I've ever heard, but it's a moment in an ecology talk when somebody says, but what are we supposed to do about this, you know? And I say probably loads of things, but my job is to get you to hesitate, right? To not do something that you think is doing something, right? It's beyond your concept of doing something. And that's the problem, you know? And that we have this idea that there is this thing agency that definitely isn't, you know, or these other things which are kind of passive. And so another way of saying what you're saying is that you find yourself, when you read Depeche, on a kind of Möbius strip in which the geological and the human are inseparably intertwined and yet different, right? And it's a very weird surface to be on, because it's what in topology is called non-orientable. That means it doesn't have an inside or an outside, or a top or a bottom, or a front or a back, right? So you can't tell where the flip occurs between geology and the human, between nature and the human. There always is a twist everywhere, right? And that's because there is no human, in the sense that there is no kind of Marmite or Vaseline of the human underneath the human appearance, right? And yet, and one is going to say this again quite boringly, we did that. You know, we invented cars and all that shit, right? And also, there is no nature, right? There are just discrete entities without a big overarching umbrella that separates them off from other entities, right? And those entities can be groups of entities as well as, you know, one entity. They can be groups of entities counted as one, right? So a coral reef could be an entity, like, but one coral is also an entity. So nature is actually not nature. It's sets of things that include things that aren't themselves. And getting used to that would be good, you know, that for a kickoff, you know, and maybe getting used to it is a political act, like not that we have to get used to it before we do the right thing, which could also suck, but that in the process of realizing that all things are toys, including political forms, right, we are attuning ourselves to that, right, so that we can make political forms. But we know that they're fragile, you know, and contingent in a physical way as well as in a kind of epistemological way, right? Insofar as they're groups of beings, and they don't have this agency thing that we're trying to spot. What they are little assemblages of people, human people, cats, wheat, you know, and these little Lego toys are always incomplete, right, by definition. They can't be everything, right? That's sort of why Heidegger gets it wrong, right? There can't be this total contexture of equipment, right, that just kind of is completely vacuum sealed into itself, right? So I'm not saying we should do nothing in a kind of Zen-like way, but I'm also not saying that, you know, doing nothing is a stupid Zen-like narcissistic thing that you should avoid, and you should actually, you know, put your shorts on and run up a hill and go, you know, join the Boy Scouts, right? Like, it's paradoxical, and sort of, whatever you do is wrong. You know, whatever you do is wrong. Like, you drive a Prius, you know, it's wrong, right? Obviously, it's not going to save the Earth, right? But neither is driving a leaf blower in a cynical statement that driving Priuses will not save the Earth, right? And, you know, and you can scale that up to, you know, stopping global warming is going to be done in a wrong way, you know, that is destructive and confusing and not coherent, right? So it doesn't matter what scale you're at. There's always some kind of built-in wrongness, right? Is that helping?
Can I follow up on that? Because when you say, we caused this, and you said, not polar bears, and some other cute thing, baby seals.
Yes.
By what you're saying, you could have an Anthropocene without humans, because you could say, say humans didn't exist.
Right.
Polar bears...
Right.
Don't exist without making a mark.
Right, right, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, so yes, right.
So we, on the one hand, it is we.
Yes.
Because I see this point, we want to say, we think humans are exceptional. My Chakrabarty point is, we thought human exceptionalism was bad, and now we've got to re-accept ourselves.
Yes.
Because we are badder.
Yes. Oh, I know.
Yeah. And there seems to be something different between Chakrabarty and what you're saying. Because Chakrabarty does have... Okay, we've got to go back to... Whereas we used to have white humans as the bad guys.
Right.
Right. Now we've got to have humans as the bad guys. So he's scaling up.
Oh, yes.
But you're scaling up.
Yes.
Right, okay, you've got to have not just humans, not just white male humans, not just white male and female humans, not just modern humans. Humans...
Yes.
And polar bears. What was the other cute thing?
I had so many
cute
ones because I wanted to kind of produce a whole toy shop of cute things. But, like, yes, and that's actually precisely one of the points in the refutation of the argument that it is hubristic, right? That it's a human thing. Because, of course, you know, we exist inside a series of nested catastrophes that can't be too much peeled apart. Like, we are starting our car engines because we can breathe oxygen, and internal combustion engines work because of oxygen, and oxygen works because of a bacterial catastrophe, right?
Yeah.
And so if Depeche was a bacteria, he could write a book or an essay that said, we bacteria, you know, we are obviously bad bacteria. And that's the problem with Depeche's argument, and that's why I keep trying to tell him, you know, Depeche, if you could, like, see it this way, this is how it works better, but you have to accept that temporality isn't a linear sequence, and that we're not the worst thing. But nevertheless, we did do a thing that now envelops Earth in the same way that oxygen envelops Earth, right?
But the concept of catastrophe is something that I have a problem with, because catastrophe, if you talk about that, is exactly usually conceived of something that you're the passive victim of.
Yes.
We are guarded not the passive victims of this catastrophe, but we were rather active in bringing it about.
Well...
The question is, if we have been so active in bringing it about, will a reconceptualization of agency itself suffice, or is that we've created the mess, we've got ourselves out of it, because... The rest of the world.
Yeah, I think it's much more than.
Yeah.
It's
not true.
Yeah. No, but not even. I mean, if the gas deposits on the Arctic go up in the air, then maybe that just gives so much more carbon dioxide that you get a bacteria in the ocean which feeds an algae which doesn't. So, you know.
Well. The global warming science on that actually is that it doesn't help. Right, like, but I see what you're saying. The danger of this conversation, which isn't just you, but the danger of what I'm sort of saying, which is often said to me, which is You're just saying we can sort of sit back and relax and not do anything at all and not really care, you know. We don't have to care anymore, you know, because the climate has always been changing, which is why I think that Karen Pinker says this, but like, to me, that's also something conservative Republicans say a lot. Well, the climate has always been changing. All kinds of non-humans have also done this. So why should we care? The thing is that it's not so much the concept as the necessary locked in position attitude with which that sentence is said, right? It's why global warming, you know, the phrase global warming peaked in 1988 when the IPCC released its first report and they started talking about it. And slowly, slowly, slowly it's gone away. And this is because of a false war against the very concept of it, run by the right, where they do this divide and conquer thing, which is to say, you guys have now changed it to climate change, which means that this global warming thing isn't true, right? In fact, global warming is a much more recent term, and climate change is the older. It goes way back to 1958, actually, is the first use of climate change in a scientific paper. Nevertheless, that concept that the climate has always been changing has been a kind of PR disaster, right? For people who want us to care about non-humans, you know. I think it's a disaster, not because, again, of what it's saying, which is true, but like, you know, how Blake writes poems that are lies in the form of the truth, you know, which would be a kind of minimalistic definition of ideology, right? That actually it is said with an attitude of knowing completely reality. You know, I know that the climate has always been changing because I can see all of it, right? And, you know, so somehow what it lacks is the appropriate sort of affect, right? It lacks the shock, horror, the appropriate reaction, right, to seeing some polar bear drowning, right? Like, I'm not going to save this polar bear because she's a member of the polar bear species, right? That's like a really whack reason to save anything. Like, I'm going to be nice to you because you exemplify what, you know, Homo sapiens, you're an example of Homo sapiens, so I'm going to be nice to you. I'm nice to you for no reason, fundamentally. I'm nice to you because it, as we were talking yesterday, it makes me feel nice. It's pleasurable to include you in my narcissistic loop, right? For no reason other than a kind of aestheticized, you know. So it's not a kind of just do it, you know, ethics I'm saying here. It's like a kind of seductive, erotic compulsion emanating from other entities that I want to include in my eroticism that has no point whatsoever, like a poem or a flower or a virus, you know. Or, you know, are these things alive? Are they intelligent? We can never check, right? And so there's a problem with Depeche's way of talking, because he's talking about the unique, specific badness, right? And it's not the unique, specific badness. It's more like our lack of being able to attune to non-humans, right? That's not evil, you know. That's just something that we can extend it, right? You know, some monasteries, they teach generosity by getting the nuns or monks to like pass a ball to the other hand. That's like the first generosity thing. You give your other hand the ball, right? You're not giving it to some, you're not giving your whole life savings to some other creature, right? You're just giving yourself the ball, right? And that's like the taboo thought, right? That you could give yourself the pleasure, you know, as a priority, as a possibility condition for being nice to, you know, not just polar bears, but things that aren't cute. Somehow you can resonate to things that aren't cute, right? And some things that aren't cute, if you made them cute, would look very disturbing and uncanny and wouldn't be cute, right? So it's not about, you know, sort of bowdlerizing things to look like me. But it is like a kind of anthropomorphism that's irreducible, because it's an anthropomorphism that I can't help doing and thinking and feeling and saying, because in the same way that I am a member of the human species, it's kind of, it's unconscious, right? It's not just unconscious in thought. It's my total phenomenological style, whatever we want to call it, right? It's not the same. Depeche would say, this is where Depeche is quite good, right? Because he's not saying it is humans as this identifiable thing, as opposed to, you know, this really identifiable thing. And yet, it obviously isn't, you know, some, you know, frozen lump of ice on Jupiter.
I just wanted to elaborate a little bit upon this idea that we were talking about last night about the narcissism. So what we were talking about was about I finally was able to admit that I want to save the world because it makes me feel good. And this is something we were talking about and looking at narcissism. But something you said just about 15 minutes ago was that narcissism is a path for agency. I think it's roughly what you said. It's not a path, but it's something. It's a place where we can go to look at, right? So I just wanted to complicate that a little bit, because yes, narcissism is something that's absolutely taboo, and it's like, whoa, we can't touch that. It's an emotional minefield. We'll have to look in at ourselves, and that's scary, right? Bring up that big mirror to ourselves. Okay, so we're going there. We can be narcissists. Mm. But then also, it's also important to not completely embrace narcissism as the only way. It also needs to be complicated with ideas of selflessness.
Right.
Like, you can't just be narcissistic.
Yes.
You have to be selfless.
Yes.
And have that balance and hold the tension between the
yes.
two.
I would love to clarify this. I'm not sure I really said that once you've become sufficiently narcissistic, then you can kick it away like the ladder, and then go and do real proper things. I think I said that loop-like forms are always around, right? And that's why we are in the Archaeolithic rather than the Neolithic or the Paleolithic. There are already relations with non-human entities, always already. And one of those non-human entities is narcissism, actually. Like, when I experience beauty, I'm having a relationship with something that isn't me, and it so isn't me that I can't specify that it's not me, right? It's much more not me, because I can't tell the difference between when me stops and the entity, you know, the Mona Lisa or whatever it is, starts, right? And that's irreducible, right? I can't cut little bits out of it and say, oh, that's the beautiful bit of the Mona Lisa and make a million photocopies of the smile or whatever, right? And I can't isolate in me the active ingredient, whether chemical or cognitive, and then say, well, if I just amplify this, I know, I found the chemical, I'm going to make it a million times stronger. Let's call it MDMA. I don't know why I hadn't thought of that, but... And then let's have it, instead of feeling beauty, instead of having Mona Lisa's, instead of making poems, you can just take this pill. That's what you sort of can't do. And so there's already a relationship to some kind of irreducible otherness, right, that is more scary than supposedly other beings, because it also might be me. It sort of entails me, but it isn't exactly me, right? And so already within narcissism, there is a relating to this otherness, you know. And this would be why, you know, esoteric, you know, in the VIP lounge of Axial Age religions, there are often these little rooms that say, actually, you know, all this stuff is just, you know, stupid, and you are directly it, you know. We tend to dismiss those things because they are just experiences, but then we have an ontology already about a difference between experience and reality that we want to question. And there is an ontology of narcissism that says it's just selfish, right? And that's exactly what I'm trying to say it isn't, right? It's like, even just to yourself, even just the self-pleasuring one isn't selfish. That's what we have to kind of say, I think, over and over again, right? That even without, you know, penguins involved, you know, even if it really is just me, you know, it's not me, because it's not selfish, because there is no self in the first place to be selfish with. The self concept is a metaphysical construct that doesn't really exist, right? So when I pleasure myself, I experience the dissolution of this self concept, which is why in the end it's a bit freaky, you know, which is why in the end, for me, art that is a bit like soft and is more scary, right? Because it's involving pleasure, you know, rather than pushing, right? Which doesn't explain why I talk the way I do. Because when I talk, I push. That's my style, is to push people.
Does this, you know, partially affirm the notion of narcissism connect with Foucault's notion of ethics as taking care of the self?
Yeah, care of the self. It sort of strikes me that it's somewhat similar to that, right? Yes. And I can't make great arguments as to why that's the case, but it does seem pretty intuitive that this kind of self-care, which is precisely exemplified by places like SLM, right, which Zizek and conservative commentators like to diss, right, these Californian places where you can actualize yourself, right? Because, you know, when you take a video of someone pleasuring herself or himself, it is always ridiculous, right? So when you make a video of someone, you know, meditating, you know, or doing yoga, or, you know, hitting each other with pillows or something, it's implicitly ridiculous. So if you're Jared Curtis, who has made Foucauldianism into a kind of packaged for export pop culture thing, you can deploy it as a kind of cynical reason, right? And say, you know, look at those stupid idiots trying to give themselves pleasure, which ultimately is a performance of Britishness that really should be, like, wiped off the face of the earth, right? Is definitely caught up in the kind of imperial logistics that are also part of agri-logistics, right? And so Foucault, actual Foucault, rather than, you know, Foucauldianism, or, like, the sort of pop version of it that's now a very successful TV show about how we've always already been programmed for our place in the world. Oh my God! You know, with no hope of escape, right, which would be why you're thinking about agency, right? We're always totally stuck, right? That's the tragic thought, right? Oh my God, my attempt to escape the web of fate was the web of fate. Oh shit, I better stick needles in my eyes, right? Rather than, you know, do what Foucault did, which is to go to Death Valley and take some acid, and then think all these things that he thought. But we tend to delete that bit of Foucault, right? That sort of 70s bit of him, you know. So yeah, totally. Like, bead curtains, you know, versus anthropocentrism, I think.
I think it's still part of my reaction to all this, and it's getting clear to me, and I really appreciate this. Almost, you said it's a delusive thing. The death of our encounter with the natural world brings about almost a dissolution of the subject, or something like that. And it's a hesitation. It's a moment where we stop and we think about the state of things. Mm-hmm. Yet, to me, this whole global climate change that's happening is so big. And I mean, it's industries, it's, mm-hmm. it's logics of capitalism mm-hmm. that are ongoing. And it's mm-hmm. not our discourses that particularize things that are necessarily going to have any impact.
Right.
Or counter to this, except at a fragmentary level. And so I'm thinking, I mean, because a lot of the talk about systems, you know, include people that take systems for absolutes and then don't see the floor in their logical thinking. Mm. And I would compare this, I'm thinking here, how Marx has said, which to some extent build up my confidence in reason. And how is it reason? He says, it's not that the whole Nazi regime was the it was poor reasoning compared to a better form of government that did what would have been, you know, might have been an alternative, a better alternative. Mm-hmm. And the idea of Joseph, I'm right to say, is really about that let's not focus on John Rawls' The Perfect Theory of Justice, but let's look at all the problems on which there's a very strong consensus. There are lots of things we can, we should be dealing with.
Oh, I hear what you're saying.
Solving particular issues rather than...
Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
Building up
I hear what you're saying.
System. And
it's
also people in the post-colonial world be that cheaper, where we're thinking, do we need a return of ideology almost, but which factors in capabilities of human beings?
Yeah.
The individual agents, it has to become a collaboration.
Yes.
To counterweight what is obviously really well organized forms of extraction of the mineral resources of the planet.
Right.
And this is so organized.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because I could be heard as saying, you know, of making the distinction that you're opening sentences we're making, not you in particular, but the sentences we're making a distinction between doing little things that I can manage and cope with, and then this huge big bad thing that does things despite me, right? And that, to me, is a reason why, and this is why I'm going to immediately lose about 90% of everybody here, but thank goodness most people are Deleuzians, so they might not worry about it so much. I'll put it this way. Some Marxism might not be correct. Not just a bad idea, but an incorrect idea, right? One of the ways in which it might be incorrect is assuming that there is this thing called capitalism, right? There might be, on the other hand, little capitalisms everywhere. If you look at the kind of Braudel micro-history of it, you see that, right? And so it has some kind of granularity. Now, the other point is that in order for the theory to work, you know, and it's that crucial chapter of Volume 1 of Capital about what machines are, right? Machines are collections of other machines, which is a nice recursive thing to say, right? Machines are steam engines plus other things. And what's cool about steam engines for Marx is cool for me too, which is that they're all-purpose general machines, right? They can be plugged into anything, right? And it's paradoxically this idea of a general-purpose machine, which is not dissimilar to the idea of a universal Turing machine, or indeed of a music synthesizer, right? A computer can pretend to be a piece of paper. It can pretend to be, you know, a music hall. It can pretend to be, you know, a pen, right? It can pretend to be... So paradoxically, the steam engine and its logical, you know, descendant, the computer, reveals something correct about what things are in general, which is that they pretend to be things, they pretend to be themselves, right? So that's ironic, but I'll go back to the wrong bit, which is that there's clearly some anthropocentric code, right, in thinking that economic relations are... First of all, economic relations make things real for Marx. He's in that Kantian lineage, but he's not a subject that makes it real, it's economic relations, right? And those economic relations are between humans, let's face it, right? And so when people say ecological stuff to some Marxists, they immediately think, you're just making universalistic generalizations, right? But what, from the ecological philosophy point of view, you're saying is not a generalization, it's a very accurate statement at a larger magnitude, right, than the kind of human magnitude, or smaller magnitude, but it's at some scale that isn't exactly, you know, the kind of easy think scale that we've become used to, right? And so it's not just about the fact that, you know, some forms of actualization of Marxism are oppressive, or that they are still agri-logistical even, it's that this basic difference, which comes in the chapter about machines, because he has to describe, you know, how we make these things, you know, is a difference between what Thomas was saying, you know, nature incarnated in the bee, who just functions in an algorithmical way, and humans who imagine things and project, and so the worst of architects is always better than the best of bees, right? First of all, prove it, right? There's plenty of empirical evidence that ants, like, look around themselves before they climb up tiny ladders, right? And then also prove that I have special imagination or agency or whatever that is. I have some special... Prove that I'm thinking now, right? But the larger point is I've forgotten the larger point. So let's just stay with the smaller point, right? And let's just say that maybe there's not so much of a gigantic difference between the big thing and the small thing, especially not if you're thinking ecologically, right, where this thing called capitalism, which is interlocking machines producing capital for its own sake, is like here, right, to some extent, but not everywhere. It's a thing that happens.
I'm surprised when we deterritorialize businesses into machines. I didn't expect that if you were so precise in a lot of these concrete objects you're dealing with, towards people for the analysis of the literature.
Right.
It's just that we're talking about corporations, multinational corporations,
yes,
have a purpose that is just to make more money.
Right.
And it will accommodate a lot of elements from the culture of the workers, as long as it doesn't interfere with the business.
Yeah.
And so we have something, we're facing something that has devised for itself a purpose. And this is the easy way to think about it, but it's the way it's functional. And it's functional at a scale that we've never seen, at the intensity of it, the development of it worldwide, and the impact it's having over the ecosystem.
Well, what I might say about that is that since I don't believe in agency, I have to come up with some other reason why we could get rid of it, you know, without getting rid of it, which is maybe the opposite of accelerationism, actually, or accelerationism upside down, right? I think that, you know, obviously the Second World War was the kind of Captain Kirk Turing sentence that he says to the computer to make it blow up. The Second World War was that to a certain kind of imperialism, right? It was an insoluble problem that caused that form of imperialism to sort of fracture, right? And so I wonder whether global warming is this Turing sentence, right, this Gödel sentence for those multinational global corporations. You know, I wonder whether it is. I can't prove that it is. But that might be, if that's the case, that might be a way to think that even if it is a huge, all-encompassing beast, that we can't get rid of because we're so puny.
What if it's the opposite? What if you look at Hurricane Katrina? Let's just assume, for purposes of the argument, that it was caused, that it was part of anthropogenic climate change. Hurricane Katrina didn't damage the corporation. If you take Naomi Klein's disaster capitalism and give them an opportunity and look at it increases, and it's sometimes it's not because of agency, it's not because of good reasoning, it's almost this blind will, isn't it? I mean, it's not because they've sat there and calculated this flagrant opportunity. Right. They didn't cause Hurricane Katrina. Well, they did, but they didn't intentionally, with agency, cause Hurricane Katrina. But every time something catastrophic comes along, it becomes as if it were agential, and that's in a way, that's the agency of the maybe Thomas is talking about. With it's we didn't say, oh, it'd be really good if we had slavery and worldwide oppression and life for 50% of humans suck, but a desire. Or an anxiety has this effect, and then one seizes upon it. Oh, that's pretty good.
And I think that brings us actually back to the concept that we're talking about, and that is sublime. I think the content sublime is simply the mini story of the Enlightenment.
The what story?
Kant's story of the sublime.
It's the what story?
It's the mini story mini of the Enlightenment, per se, right? We have a passivity that we cannot manage, and then Lucian jumps in, yellow, but I can't save you, right? And there's a very interesting book by Tatiana Tiki, who's talking about the technological sublime, which is basically that, of course, we have invented all these machines actively in order to dominate the planet, or another, to get rid of contingencies, to power ourselves, right? But that has gotten out of control, basically, right? So we find ourselves at the receiving end of the very machines for agency that we actually invented, right? But I don't think that to not believe in agency, I do think that if you do not want to believe in agency, then the one thing that you have to kind of keep into account is that agency requires something else, and that's passivity, right? And the problem that we have in historiography that is only written not only from the perspective but on the basis of agency, right?
Yeah.
Is where we've gone terribly wrong, because history is not only made by those people who have agency, but history is made by those who suffer.
Yes. I'm afraid. I'm afraid that
might kind of create another form of another concept of agency.
Right.
But
right.
I don't think we cannot simply do away with agency, and because it doesn't fit.
Okay, I'm dealing with two slightly different questions. I'm still thinking about this big beast that we can't get rid of problem, right? And for some reason, I'm this guy who analyzes, you know, axioms and sentences and things by, you know, like Hegel, sort of like, or like any kind of close reader of a poem, like analyzing the attitude that for which the sentence is selecting, right? Again, it's not agency in a certain way, because in a way, the poem is a kind of advert for a certain kind of attitude. Are you this kind of person? Take our Cosmo quiz and find out, right? Interpolation, right? And, you know, and again, it sounds so crystal-gazing, new-agey, 70s, in a very threatening and way that therefore I find quite useful to say, to me, it's how you believe, you know, not what you believe is the problem. How you, what is your belief about belief, right? With which you think there are these insurmountable obstacles that always co-opt whatever I do, right? The kind of cultural studies discussion about the authentic versus the sellout. Now that is taking place, or the appropriation of the disaster within the logic of capital, right? That's always already taking place, actually, within consumerist possibility space, right? In the same way that Wordsworth, who is always talking about the complicity of people and thoughts with things that are, you know, machinating away, is like Johnny Rotten, right? And the idea of punk, which is also the idea of that Wordsworthian romanticism, and finally also of John Ashbery, right? Although it's very, very nice slow motion vomit. It's the same idea that if I could just say something disgusting enough in a disgusting enough way, you might get, you know, unaddicted to it. You might cease the horrible evil loop. In other words, there's an intrinsic, it's not so much that capital swallows things, yeah, sure, it's that we're thinking that the idea that things swallow things to become more of what they are as evil, right? We think that loops are evil, right? And that immediately makes me sound like a bourgeois shit, you know, to a certain kind of Marxism that is precisely saying there isn't just beauty, right? In the way that Adorno found very problematic, right? That actually aura is not something that you can peel off of an artwork, just like for me you can't peel off appearance of the thing without some violence, because it's irreducibly glued to it and you can't find where the glue is, right? And so there's another path within consumerist possibility space, right, that has to do not with trying to vomit as convincingly as possible, right, but has to do with some kind of embrace of pleasure, right? It's the kind of Marxism that might say the problem with this particular reality is that it's not pleasurable enough, right? Not that it gives us these false pleasures and co-opts our, you know, revolutionary dreams into its machination, but that actually it's not enough of itself, actually. It's not giving us nearly enough of the, you know, wide variety of erotic forms of enjoyment that include eating peaches and looking at yourself and whatever, and all the sorts of things that Keats' poems are about, right? Like, there's not enough pleasure, right? I'm going to, instead of trying to upgrade your thought where I can, because I'm more right than you because I can see through you, right? I'm more right than you because I can say there's this even bigger thing that eats the capitalism thing even, and it's, we need to be even more cynical, right? Like, imagine if the entropy at the end of the universe could talk, right, if the entropy at the end of the universe could go on Oprah and say, well, that stupid fucking planet Earth with its global warming, that was just shit, you know. That was nothing compared to my majestic, enormous, destructive violence, you know. It's the cynicism with which, not you again, but in the structure of that kind of sentence, that kind of thought, that is something that I want to mess with, right? I actually think that the exit route is through the Keats path, which sort of goes, you know, Keats, Baudelaire, aestheticism, you know, and there are these really ecological Baudelaire poems which are about being, you know, surrounded by disgusting, weird things that I can't peel off me. They're sort of ennui, right, as a kind of ecological affect, actually, rather than as a bad, evil consumerism.
That's impersonal.
Yes.
You know,
right. It's impersonal.
You know, when you said, I don't save the polar bear because it's a polar bear, it's not, right. I must save you because you're human.
Right, right.
It's only ethical when it's non, it doesn't, it's because you're
it's an instance of X. It's not personal. Yes.
It's just one is magically.
Yes.
What would you say if people would say that, well, this is simply another form of cynicism? Because, you know, I'm at least afraid that some people might take this kind of wounded narcissism, to say not with a bit of pleasure in it, as a very quietist notion.
I'm not saying wounded narcissism, I'm saying actual narcissism.
Yeah. Which could be interpreted as simply, okay, never mind about narcissism, as long as you take into account that this ego is connected to
right. That's what people say. They say, you know, Tim is a pathetic, weak guy who doesn't even critique anything anymore, and his arguments are just, you know, and I sort of like being the object of that cynical gaze, you know, and for some reason I sort of magnetize it, right, and people go, but just tell us what to do, you know, give us a program that gets us out of this horrible loop. And I'm trying to say over and over again, but no one can hear it, not even me, that wanting to get out of the loop is the loop. The loop is precisely caused by wanting to escape from a loop, right? So the first thing you need to do is stop trying to escape from the loop. So the first thing you need to develop are philosophical forms of allergy medicine, right, that allow you to tolerate, if only for 1 second, the loop-like form of your ecological awareness, right? So it's, again, you know, like the concept quietism already assumes, you know, first of all, it's an ism. It's part of consumerism. The big ism in the room is consumerism, right? It's a self-reflexive something. And isms are bad because they are precisely self-reflexive, right? That ism. You're just styling yourself in a certain way. And I've got my style. And like the nightmare of why the MLA really sucks, right? But you've got these people who position themselves, you know, all the time without actually talking, you know? And yet, and at the same time, ism, you can't... Well, no, in a certain way it isn't, actually. In a certain way it isn't. For example, the American Academy of Religion conference, right, they have a format where you talk for 10 minutes about your paper, and then there's not just an hour discussion, there's like a three-hour discussion with four panelists, and you really go in there, right? And also, but also, as a function of this, people wear their weird, perverted enjoyment on their sleeves, right? Like, the MLA would be so much better if people wore huge, big, floppy ears, right? Rather than the kind of, I'm not wearing anything, black clothing that, you know, allows you to perform, I've seen through everything, you know? Because the sentence, I've seen through everything, hasn't seen through everything, right? And that's the kind of Marxism that I'm trying to kind of delete, you know? Because, or cause to resonate in a funky way that it wouldn't like, you know. Because it's that sort of sentence that's saying, you know, I'm not just a self-filating narcissist. I'm a real, proper, acting person, you know. And it's the kind of sentence that performs precisely agri-logistics, right? Let's get down to it. We don't really want flowers. What we want is more grain, right? We don't really want, you know, pleasure. What we want is more you know, wealth or something, or more production or more, you know. And so everything else from that point of view looks like quietism, right? But somehow quietism could be... Why, in a way, you can tell that the quietism is still cool and interesting because it's so threatening to the attitude that supposedly thinks that it's useless. Why would it be useless? Why would it be threatening if it was so useless? It's like how, you know, Plastic People of the Universe was a much more scary band in that part of Eastern Europe than the agitprop bands that were actually singing against communism. Plastic People of the Universe were just doing weird psychedelic stuff, and they were the guys who got the surveillance and like the imprisonment and all that, right? Because in a way, capitalism can't tolerate more pleasure, right? Only that much, right? And so, like, finding new pleasure pathways, since I don't think that capitalism is the top object under whose aegis everything fits, because it's, you know, I believe in contradictory sets, is a legitimate tactic, you know. Whether it gets us out of anything, I don't know, you know. But yeah, it comes to this point where I say I'm quite happy with being seen as a weak, lame hypocrite, right? And that in my view, cynicism, when it's at Earth magnitude, collapses into hypocrisy anyway, right? Because cynicism is hypocritical about its own hypocrisy, right? Since I can't achieve escape velocity cognitively from the biosphere, like since even if I go to Mars, I have to make a biosphere from scratch, I've got the same problem even worse, right? I can't achieve the kind of distance that would allow me to have the final say, you know. And so being right can't be about having the final say. It might be more like admitting that I'm, you know, like the cup that you get in America if you're part of the kind of, you know, we won't give drugs to our children thing or do drugs in front of our children. It says world's number one hypocrite on the cup. That's the cup that everyone's holding in an ecological awareness age. Right?
Yeah.
And we can't get rid of it, right? Because of interdependence, because of a fact about ecology, you see. And so somehow, this is just my, the way my weird mind works, but I just look at the attitude with which, not that the sentence is said, but the attitude that the sentence selects for, right? Like chairs, they select, in any, this is my hypothesis, right? In any room, there are always more chairs than people, right? Prove me wrong, right? But chairs are... You know, people have become vectors for these things, you know, and they don't help you at all, right? They actually shorten your life, but somehow we can't help wanting them because now everybody must have a chair, not just the invading tyrant who sits on his enemies, you know, as a sort of humiliating gesture. We must all do that, right? And they're so easy to make, like in Design 101, you'd make a chair, right? And it's so easy and practical and kind of, it sort of relaxes you that we keep on making them to the extent that, you know, after humans really do become extinct, there will just be huge piles of chairs everywhere, you know, everywhere we live, you know. So it's not like, so let's try to make toys that are more compelling than chairs, is the point. You know, let's try to make earworms that are more compelling than Justin Bieber. You know, although I have a soft spot for Katy Perry, actually, so I'm not going to bring her in. No.
Let's make
images, you know, that are more compelling than some corporate logo, rather than trying to have no logo, which is the, you know, the Klein approach. Let's try to make really amazing logos that really, you know, blow your mind so much that you don't want to have a Coke, you know. More enjoyment, right?
Let's head over.
Oh, okay. So I really loved what you said when you were deconstructing Marxism about little capitalism all over the place. I think that's perfect. And I'd like to employ two metaphors in the story. First is I'd like to bring a little blues back, blues and guitar, and one thing I know.
Oh, bring him in.
It's the rise of.
Bring them in.
How capitalism is so hard to get rid of because it's all over the place. It's just like, and then second metaphor, the virus. It's like a virus. It's not just in one place. It's like, it replicates and it goes to different places and it's contagious. right? And so, but if you think of it, like machines, you know, what if people, civilizations, groups of people everywhere, they're like machines, they're like computers, and this virus, this capitalism, whatever, is a code. It's like malicious code, code that infects these different computers, travels around, and the system is there, the looping is there, but the code can be tweaked. Third thing I want to say is I love what Claire said about the Hurricane Katrina and how things can be hijacked. There's a story that came out a couple of weeks ago about this group of artists, performers in the United States called the Yes Men.
Oh, yes.
And they have this Department of Defense meeting in Washington, D.C., in a real Department of Defense meeting, and they hijacked it, and they had all the defense contractors there, and everyone was bidding, trying to get a bid for this new contract, and they went and announced that they were going to shift to accommodate to climate change and by do 100% renewable energy by the year 2030. And everyone just went nuts. All the defense contractors loved it. Everyone was so enthusiastic about this. Like, everyone believed it. It was completely realistic. They had a Department of Homeland Security there. They had the Department of Indian Bureau of Indian Reservation. And they had this fake character there, and he led everyone in this song and dance around the room, and even the defense contractors who had been there to try and get, war bids or whatever, had been hijacked into this whole setup and really enthusiastic about mobilizing their whole industry, changing the virus.
Yeah.
Keeping the system going.
Yeah.
But changing the system.
Yeah. Well, how do you get rid of a virus? You know, if you try to get rid of it very, aggressively, you make it worse, right? You sort of have to make a nicer virus that's better than that virus, that could... So in a way, I'm actually saying all code is malicious, in a way. There is a kind of... Not that I believe in evil in particular, but there is something like evil about appearance, right? That you can't get rid of because you don't know exactly what it is, And that's what I actually like about Avatar, is that not the explicit content, but the slightly evil, luminous, fluorescent, artificial-looking, sort of glowing structures in it that look like eyes and whatever, the eyes of these people. So appearance has this kind of... is a bit... It could be malicious, right? You could get suckered, by it. And you can't ever achieve the proper distance towards it now that you know things about how ecological awareness involves multiple scales, right? And so rather than putting you into a reality that's definitely much more real, than the one that we've been in, it puts you into a more kind of feeling of unreality, as a kind of index of the kind of larger reality. Like, that's a common global warming affect, right? That suddenly there's a feeling of unreality. I can't believe it, I can't actually see it. I can't believe it. Even if you believe it, you feel unreal in the same way that when you're in a car accident, talking of deceleration, you realize that time is not a linear sequence. You feel like you're suddenly outside time, dissociated, right? And so there's a kind of dissociation, which again is about, finding some non-humanness in your mind stream, not just in Simon, and so somehow it's not about replacing malicious code with code that's nicer, right, in a way. It's like making code that's even more sexy and therefore slightly more scary seeming to somebody who has a rigid concept of good and evil, right? So this is another way why I'm calling it gnosis, eco-gnosis, right? Because it's a kind of knowing that is embodied isn't the right word at all. But it's without being embodied, it is, as Claire was pointing out, it makes you, it's kind of high, you know, it's a sort of drug. It's not different from, intoxication somehow, or hallucinating very much, right? It's like thought intoxicating itself to disarm itself somehow, right? So again, you know, I'm this weak, lame, quiet person, you know. But somehow that seems more right to me than wanting to, you know, destroy this thing that isn't me all the time, that I think isn't me all the time, right? And so if that means that I look like someone who's a sellout, I'm sort of okay with that, because I don't think that's the only move in consumerist possibility space. I don't think insisting that you're not a sellout is the only thing you can do. Like, you know, don't you ever get the feeling you've been cheated? You know, that's not the only thing you can say, right? You could do some kind of goth version of that, right? That was slightly more pleasurable, but slightly weird and slightly connected up to consumerism, actually, you know, where you had big, huge hair like Fat Bob, you know, and you sang songs about ennui, right? You went the sort of Baudelaire path, you know, which is the sort of goth path, you know, for instance, right? And that might be kind of further inside what I take to be this thing that I call a chocolate. It's a chocolate. Ecological awareness is a chocolate with like lots of layers inside it. The outer coating is guilt. Inside that is the shame, which is the chocolate. Inside that is some kind of objection, which puts you into melancholia, which is this sort of hard, sort of rather non-liquid, cherry-flavoured melancholia. And inside that is a sort of slightly more liquid centre of sadness, right? So you're getting less and less and less conceptual. And then inside of that, there's some kind of, you know, complete joy, right? But you have to get to the joy through the horror and the depression rather than despite it, right? You can't jolt yourself out of what you know, right? Which is that you're drinking stuff that has wrong stuff in it, right? And you're flushing it into this ocean all the time.
I'm afraid I'll have to take a food metaphor and re-associate ourselves.
On that note,
I'm afraid I'm a bad boy here. because the lunch is waiting, but thank you very much.